Well, I would like to add my welcome to those who are joining us online, and I'm guessing we have at least a few more on the West Coast, a spouse of somebody that's actually here, so that's kind of cool. And I think my wife is on today's, which is also good. Well, brethren, we all have needs. Now, I suppose that's not a surprise to anyone sitting here, but we all have basic needs that we all have to do work or strive to meet. We have needs for food, water, shelter, rest, security, safety, on and on and on. But we all have these fundamental needs. And for most people, most of the time, most of the basic needs are met. And few, if any of them, would cause you to alter your beliefs, change your behaviors, or modify your attitudes. They're just needs. Again, water doesn't cause you to do that. Shelter doesn't cause you to do that. But we also have psychological needs. And this is a slightly different category, because in addition to our basic physiological needs, these psychological needs are a slightly bit higher order. They're more intrinsic. They're bound within each human. They're things like the need to love and be loved, the need for friendship, the need for intimacy, the need for respect. And again, this list can go on and on. There is one need that is interesting and one I want to explore today that does actually change us. And in fact, many of the psychological ones can actually alter who you are. I want to talk about the need to belong. And we all have it. We all have a need to belong to something. It is a human emotional need to be an accepted member of some group. I mean, the most common is family, of course. I mean, we're all part of some family somewhere. And we need to belong to that. It's a fundamental thing that changes who you are. You are crafted into some degree or another. You are a different person because of your family. Friend groups, they form, they change you. They alter who you are. But the friendship group is also one that is extremely fundamentally important for humans. Coworkers have a similar impact on the lives of individuals. The reality is any social group will have this impact because we need to belong to something. People have, again, this inherent desire to not just belong to something, but we also have an inherent desire to belong to something that is greater than themselves, and that's the group. Again, we belong to a church. It is greater than any one individual here. And again, as I've alluded to, what's interesting about many of these needs, but this one in particular, it changes you. The need to belong will change your behavior, and it will change your beliefs, and it will change your attitude. It does so because you strive to conform and to be accepted by the group that you're a member of. And that group dynamic affects you. It's somewhat akin to sort of the adolescent that socializes, right? I mean, everybody knows adolescents go through socializations. When they're born, they're very selfish. They only think about themselves. But as they begin to get around other kids their age, to get around other people, they socialize is the term that's given to it. They learn things like don't hit. Every kid wants to hit when they're little, but they learn that. They learn things like be nice. They learn other things like, you know, talk. If you just sit there, you're not going to have social friends. You're not going to be part of a group. People will tend to avoid you after a while. It changes you, and you might inherently have those things as a young person or a young child, but as you socialize, those are changed, right? They change who you are. You learn to share. You learn the very beneficial things. It sounds like Mike almost might have learned here a little bit, but you learn to not throw a fit. Sorry. When you work with the boss, you might get away with it at home, but at some point you learn that is not how to get your way. That is not how to progress in life. So again, this it's not exactly the same as teenager socializing, but it's akin to that because it's altering who you are. Now, in many cases, the teenagers or the adolescents that are socializing, that's really altering their behavior. But the need to belong digs deeper in us. And it affects us at a deeper level because it changes your beliefs. And that's a fundamental difference, I think, for all of this. No one can escape this. We are all bound to this. And if you think about sort of ends of spectrums here, the criminal who flouts the rules of society, or the philosopher who rises above thought. Not that those are two perfect ends of the spectrum, but it's pretty close. Both of them, again, are altered by their communities they're a part of. The only difference is they've narrowed their community that they're a member of. They've narrowed down those they're trying to please. They've narrowed down to the outlaw is trying to please his pals. He's trying to please those, you know, the three people that are in cahoots with him on committing crimes. But he's likely to become, or she is likely to become, a bigger criminal if that's who they surrounded themselves with. Philosophers sit there with their inner circle of superior thinkers, and they work and labor to gain the respect of their peers. Again, I mean, that's why there's still magazines out there that have, you know, circulation amongst just a small group of scientists, because that's who they want to impress. They just narrowed their window. But we all do this. And again, it's an important fundamental motive for all of us to understand that we are changed by these things. It alters who we are. Each one of us is affected by this, and we gain the esteem of those around us. We work toward that. Now, recognizing this basic need in ourselves and in others can be extremely, and I would argue is, essential throughout your Christian walk. But it is an extremely valuable piece of information to keep as in the forefront of our mind as we go through this life. It is important so we can focus our need for belonging in the right place and resist the urge to misplace it. And I promise you, there is an urge to misplace it. I came across two verses. And this is not normally my style, but I will confess, this was not the topic I was going to talk about today. I was actually going to talk about offenses, which almost would have went a little bit with the first split. But I came across two verses that I thought dynamically illustrated what can happen when we try to satisfy this need for belonging in the wrong place. And again, it was reading a verse about offense, but it's actually found in the Olivet Prophecy. I do want to turn over to the read. You can start turning over to Matthew 24. It's found in the Olivet Prophecy. Christ has told his disciples, hey, this temple is going to be destroyed. Again, we're familiar with the prophecy. And they ask, logical question, well, when will these things be? And what will be the sign of your coming? And after Jesus describes what he labels the beginning of sorrows, he says this. And again, it's a prophecy of what's coming, which is, again, sort of, oddly enough, this is going to sound like a weird nexus of several different things, but a prophecy of what's coming, or a study on offense and COVID, of all things, kind of led me to talk about this, because we have, when we think about social groups and we think about belonging, it's hard when one of the important groups we can't attend. We got, probably 50% of the congregation that's looking through a camera in the back there. So, and again, this idea that they also need this group. It is an important thing. And again, I know Mr. Petty has mentioned it several times, but I would strongly urge you, because again, we've been exposed to that in our life, where it's just, there are some people who cannot be here, and it gets really long. And I have felt it, actually. It's a funny, weird dynamic. I've actually missed the last two Sabbaths. And you do start to feel a little isolated. You start to feel a little alone. So it's the combination of those things. But again, Jesus, after he says, hey, these are the beginning of sorrows, he says this. We'll start, the two verses I want to read are Matthew 24, verse 9 and 10. He says this, then they will deliver you up to tribulation and kill you, and you will be hated by all nations for my name's sake. And then many will be offended and will betray one another and will hate one another. Now again, I suppose had it not been on my mind, I wouldn't have necessarily gone to, this need for, belonging and all this kind of stuff. But this is a fascinating two verses here that really illustrate, again, what can happen if we put our need for belonging in the wrong spot as a Christian ethic, if you will. Because essentially he's saying, listen, persecutions will come from non-believers. So he starts out, it's like, yeah, tribulation are going to come. They're going to hate you from the world, from the non-believers. Many will be offended. Now, again, we think, oh, somebody bothered me and offended. It's not really what it means. It says many, the other translations actually take the word offended. And if you look it up, this is, I think, a clearer explanation. Many who believed, that's the community, will fall away. That's the offense. They'll fall away. The ISV has that. ASV has stumbled. King James 3, ensnared. Many who believe will fall away. So again, we have this idea that the world's persecuting and coming after. Now the believers begin to fall away. They will betray one another, and they will end up hating those who remain faithful to Jesus. It's an interesting flow, because again, remember, the need to belong causes you to change your behaviors, your beliefs, and your attitudes. And in this two verses, we have a community in the world that is persecuting a church, and we have a community within that church that says, I'm going to change my views on things. I'm going to step out. I'm going to change my behaviors. I'm going to change my beliefs, my attitudes, and not only that, I will go after the people that remain. It's an interesting dynamic. Again, it's not something that I started out sort of looking through, but I do want to look at it. Because we are all subject to the desire to belong and to be accepted by a group. Now again, it is fair to say it is baked within us, but it is also of varying degrees. I mean, I think we all know personalities, and there are some we bump across that are very prone to wanting to belong and wanting to be accepted by a larger group. Others go through life like don't seem to care much, but at the end of the day, it's psychologically known this is a fundamental tenet of each human being. The Bible is replete with examples of people who are dedicated to following God and at points in their life betrayed God in favor of acceptance of a group. It is replete with them. I just want to look at in depth at one example. I want to look at the example of Saul. At the start, Saul was little in his own eyes. We'll read that verse. But he was little. In fact, I hadn't read this in forever, so I was like, oh, you know, you always find it intriguing when you haven't read something in a while. But in 1 Samuel 10, we see that God said he would be with them. God said he would turn him into another. This is sort of the private anointing, if you will, of Saul before his public coronation, if you will. And he said, I would be with you. I'll turn you to another man. I'm going to give you a new heart. You know, modern day, we'd call that a conversion. Because fundamentally, that's the fundamental truth of it all. When it came to the time to make a public choice, again, this is sort of under that umbrella that Samuel was small in his own eyes. Saul, the prophet, gathered all the people together at Mizpah. He started going by tribe, you know, what tribe, and this is, you know, the way they used to pick, and God told him to do it this way. But he went by tribe, then clan, then family, and went down to Saul. They couldn't even find him initially. It says they found him hiding amongst the equipment, and they pulled him out, and, you know, and again, just king, and everybody was happy. But there's the public coronation, and again, this idea that he wasn't boastful, he wasn't proud, he was a fairly modest man by this record. His first major act as king, he had a great victory over the Ammonites, and all the people rallied behind him. And interestingly, again, the credit Saul gives, he showed mercy in it because there were some people that didn't want to do this and kind of didn't really like Saul in the process. And Saul says, nope, don't leave him alone. But he also gave all the credit to God for the victory. Fast forward 2 years, and we start to get a little insight into Saul's changing and evolving motivations, if you will. We begin to get some insights into where his head and his mind was going. He was willing, and we'll read this here in a minute. You can start turning to 1 Samuel chapter 13. He was willing in this process to usurp the role of a priest. He was willing to take on that role that he was not allowed to do by law. He was not allowed. You know, again, there's lots of different roles. I would, I kind of equate this, and it's not a fair comparison because it's a sacrifice. But there are roles and there are authorities that elders get today that are not given to all of us. We don't usurp that role. We go to an elder when we need anointing. That's just the way it is. That's the role as we have it defined in the Bible. Saul was willing to usurp that and do his own thing. Jonathan in the story is, we won't read this part. Jonathan had attacked the garrison of the Philistines. And the Philistines retaliate and they come up to battle. And again, in this process, the people are scared. They begin to hide and flee. Now remember, Saul had had a great victory. But now people are scared. They're fleeing. Saul not looking too good at this point. He's kind of looking around going, okay, I'm the king and this isn't going well for me. But he needs the acceptance and the trust of the people. So let's pick this up in 1 Samuel chapter 13. We'll start in verse 8. Then Saul waited for 7 days according to the time set by Samuel. But Samuel did not come to Gilgal, and the people were scattered from him. Again, look where his primary focus is. The people were scattered. So Saul said, bring a burnt offering and a peace offering here to me. And he offered the burnt offering. Now it happened, as soon as he had finished presenting the burnt offering, that Samuel came, and Saul went out to meet him, that he might greet him. I get the sense that Saul didn't see a lot of problem with what he did. He's like, oh, well, Saul, Samuel's here. Let me go out and talk to him. I mean, after all, the sacrifice probably had his desired effect. Saul probably got, and it doesn't say this, but I would surmise he got what he wanted. My guess is the people calmed down. He looked like a strong leader. They began to focus on him again. Would be my guess. And they would see Saul then as being connected to God. Verse 11. And Samuel said, what have you done? Saul said, you can almost just imagine this discourse going back and forth. The almost innocence to it, I would argue. But Saul said, when I saw that the people were scattered from me, that's where his focus was. When I saw that the people were scattered from me, and that they did not come up, and that you did not come up within the appointed time, and the Philistines gathered together at Michmash, then I said, the Philistines will now come down on me in Gilgal, and I have not made supplications to the Lord. Therefore, I felt compelled and offered a burnt offering. He knew it wasn't right. But when he saw the people, that they were scattered from him, he felt compelled. And he wanted to fit. Again, maybe you could say, I'm reading too much on this. Hold on. Verse 13. And Samuel said to Saul, you have done foolishly. You have not kept the commandment of the Lord your God, which he commanded you. For now the Lord would have established your kingdom over Israel forever. See, again, Saul needed the acceptance of the people, and it outweighed his desire, if you will, to keep the commandment of the Lord. And he knew it. Samuel had told him, and the way this is written, Saul knew that it was against the law of the Lord. Yet he did it anyway. Now again, you could argue that he was under a mortal threat. That it was understandable what Samuel did. Now again, only the priests were authorized. But again, a few years earlier, the sacrifice was made, and he had experienced a great victory. You could argue again that he could see the direction it was heading, and that he had to prioritize his kingdom, and that it was fading away, and a great victory by the Philistines would destroy it all. But at the end of the day, he did disobey God, and he justified it. And again, I think that you could argue that. You could say, okay, but he had reason. He had cause. But again, looking at the progression, you can see the seeds of this need to be accepted. Fast forward again a few years. This will be over in 1 Samuel chapter 15. God initiates this one. God, through Samuel, tells Saul to go attack the Amalekites. and punish Amalek because he had previously attacked Israel, and he was told to utterly destroy them. I think it's interesting, we won't read this, but for note takers, if you read verse 1, Samuel very wisely reminds Saul that it was God in verse 1 who made him king. And therefore, Saul should heed the voice of the Lord. We're going to pick it up, though, in verse 7. 1 Samuel 15, verse 7. And Saul, as he did, obeyed the Lord. And Saul attacked the Amalekites from Havilah all the way to Shur, which is east of Egypt. He also took Agag, king of the Amalekites, alive and utterly destroyed all the people with the edge of the sword. But Saul and the people spared Agag and the best of the sheep, the oxen, the fatling, and the lamb, and all that was good, and were unwilling to utterly destroy them. But everything despised and worthless, they utterly destroyed. It's an interesting mental exercise to go through. Who would have made those choices? What was worth destroying and what wasn't? Especially when God said, destroy it all. Verse 10, now the word of the Lord came to Samuel, saying, I greatly regret I have set up Saul as king, for he has turned back from following me and has not performed my commandments. This is how God looks at what Saul did. I regret I made him king because he has turned away from following me. The question we could ask at this point is, who is he following? And again, I think we know the answer because we know where this is headed. And it grieved Samuel, and he cried out to the Lord all night. So when Samuel rose early in the morning to meet Saul, it was told Samuel, saying, Saul went to Carmel, and indeed he has set up a monument for himself. And he has gone on around, passed by, and gone down to Gilgal. Again, what are you setting up a monument for yourself when, at least as it's recorded for us, two battles earlier, you're giving God the credit? Verse 13, then Samuel went to Saul and said to him, blessed are you of the Lord. I have performed the commandment of the Lord. Again, in his eyes, that's what he did. He had performed the commandment of the Lord. But Samuel said, what then is the bleating of the sheep in my ears and the lowing of the oxen which I hear? And Saul said, those people have brought them back or brought them from the Amalekites. For the people spared the best of the sheep and the oxen to sacrifice to the Lord God. And the rest we have utterly destroyed. We did what the Lord said. We did what you told us to. I mean, the people, yeah, they wanted to keep all the best of this. But Saul had been given the commandment not to do that. And he acquiesced to the people. He needed to get their acceptance. He needed their approval. Again, we can ask, who was it he was serving and honoring? Was it God and his commandments? Or was it the people? In many ways, it's like this whole exercise, I just think it's funny. It's like, well, but we did serve you. We did honor you. It's like saying that you'll, you know, work on the Sabbath so that you can pay more tithes. It's like, okay, but you disobeyed. Oh, but no, I did. I'm doing a good thing. That's essentially what Saul's argument is. Verse 16, then Samuel said to Saul, be quiet. I may be reading into this, but I think Samuel was trying to save Saul a little bit from keeping on talking and potentially, you know, preserving his life. But Samuel said to Saul, be quiet, and I will tell you what the Lord said to me last night. And he said to him, okay, speak on. So Samuel said, when you were little in your own eyes, there's the phrase we mentioned earlier, were you not head of the tribes of Israel? And did not the Lord appoint you king over Israel or anoint you king over Israel? Now the Lord sent you on a mission and said, go and utterly destroy the sinners, the Amalekites, and fight against them until they are consumed. Why then did you not obey the voice of the Lord? It's a logical question. One, I think, when we find ourselves trying to be accepted by other groups ahead of our God, I think that's a question we should ask ourselves. Why did you do that? What was it that was so important about your group of friends or your coworkers that it was worth disobeying God over? That need to belong, it gets us. And Saul said to Samuel, "But I have obeyed the voice of the Lord and gone on the mission which the Lord sent me and brought back Agag, king of Amalek. I have utterly destroyed the Amalekites, but the people," again, this group, my social group, my kingdom, my people, "but the people took of the plunder, sheep and oxen, the best of the things which should have been utterly destroyed to sacrifice to the Lord your God in Gilgal." I find that interesting because he now refers to it as your God when I'm in a little bit of trouble. It's not necessarily mine, and he's arguably, in one sense, he could be right, because again, whoever you're serving is your God. He's basically saying the people wanted to do this. And again, instead of obeying God, he acquiesced to the people. He needed their acceptance. This core innate desire to be accepted, to be a part of somebody, and to, by extension, to receive the accolades coming back that, oh, yeah, you're, drove him to flat out disobey God. And again, a few chapters earlier, you don't see that. You see a transition moment, but now it's right out in the open. Verse 22, "So Samuel said, 'Has the Lord as great a delight in burnt offerings and sacrifice as in obeying the voice of the Lord? Behold, to obey is better than sacrifice, and to heed than the fat of rams. For rebellion is as the sin of witchcraft, and stubbornness as iniquity and idolatry. Because you have rejected the word of the Lord, he has also rejected you from being king.'" Again, God views that as rejecting him, because you did. Samuel did, or Saul did. He rejected what God told him to and went with the group, went with his kingdom, if you will. And again, we all have our different social groups. They cannot override what God tells you to do. And they do not have the right to become a greater authority on the morals and ethics and living Christian life than what God describes in the Bible. God's first. All of our other social groups, all of our other peer groups, all of our other dynamics have to conform to his. And again, we'll talk about that as we go along. Verse 24, "Then Saul said to Samuel, 'I have sinned. I have sinned, for I have transgressed the commandment of the Lord and your word, because I feared the people and obeyed their voice.'" It's exactly right. It's exactly why he disobeyed God. He feared him, and he obeyed him. Verse 25, "Now therefore, please pardon my sin and return with me that I may worship the Lord." Again, it may be a logical response, although I think we'll read a verse here in a minute or two that casts some shadow of doubt on that. "But Samuel said to Saul, 'I will not return to you, for you have rejected the word of the Lord, and the Lord has rejected you from being king over Israel.'" Verse 27, "Then Samuel turned around to go away. Saul seized the edge of his robe, and it tore. So Samuel said to him, 'The Lord has torn the kingdom of Israel from you today and has given it to a neighbor of yours who is better than you. And also the strength of Israel will not lie nor relent, for he is not a man that he should relent.'" He's basically saying, "I'm sorry, it's over." Now again, we won't be kings. So I think one way we could imagine this is many of us have, you know, or will be. You'll be a manager, you'll be an executive, you'll be something in a company. This is essentially having the board or your boss come in and fire you. Say, "You're out. I don't care. You did it. You did, whatever. You can kind of go through this story. We all have had a boss that, you know, we've reported to. And I try to put this in that framework because it helps me understand verse 30. "Then he said, 'I have sinned, yet honor me now, please, before what? Before God? No, he says, before the elders of my people and before Israel, and return with me that I may worship the Lord your God. Again, that's a phenomenally telling statement. He says, okay, I've been fired. I'm terminated. The kingdom is ripped from me. See, I just walked a few people up, didn't I? I'm fired. But can you just come with me and honor me before my team? Can you give me that award and the bonus and a few other things? Come on. I need their accolades. I need their praise. I need to know. They're my people. Come with me yet now so that they may see. And I will worship your God. He needed to be somebody in their eyes still, not in the eyes of God. Saul is not alone. Again, we won't go into a lot of these. I do want to turn to this one. Aaron, on the base of Mount. In fact, I'll just read it to you, and we're running. I'm going to try to finish on time. Aaron, again, I'm talking about people that love, know, and God, and still get pulled into this void, if you will, of shifting their allegiance to a social group because they need to be a part of what's going on. They want to be a part of the popular kids and the crowd and everything. Aaron, again, at the base of Mount Sinai, I'll just read it again. This is Exodus 32, verse 1 through 6. Now when the people saw that Moses delayed, and again, here we have the same kind of, all the people saw that Moses was delayed, the people, and Moses delayed coming down from the mountain, the people gathered together unto Aaron. So they come to Aaron, and they said to him, come, make us gods that shall go before us. For as for this Moses, the man who brought us up out of the land of Egypt, we do not know what's become of him. And what does Aaron do? Aaron acquiesces to the people. He says, all right. And they brought the gold, they brought the images, they come before him. And verse 5 says, so when Aaron saw it, he built the altar before it, and Aaron made a proclamation and said, tomorrow is a feast to the Lord. Again, I find it interesting because Samuel has this, and if you find some other examples, which we don't, or go through other examples, we won't have time to today. It's not uncommon for people of God to make the proclamation, I'm doing it for the Lord. It's the essence of idolatry. It's the essence of, okay, God says this, but I have a different image of what God is. I'm going to go do that. And in this case, they're just serving the people. But this idea that it's like, okay, well, we're going to do this. We just made a calf. It's a pagan thing. Okay, but we got this idol going. Everybody participated. But tomorrow we'll have a feast to the Lord and we'll celebrate. Again, I'll go back to this kind of silly example. But we don't work on the Sabbath so we can pay more tithes. You just don't do that. It doesn't make sense. Again, Aaron is acting, should have been acting, as an agent of God and of Moses. It's previously written. But at the end of the day, he was an agent of the people. Aaron had the same need to belong and get the acceptance of the people. I love Aaron's excuse, or his response, if you will. Again, for note takers, it's Exodus 32, verses 21 through 23. This is after Moses comes down. And Moses says to Aaron, what did this people do to you? I don't know. Again, try to imagine the tone and what he was thinking, but I'm like, he'd be like, what? What did this people do to you? Did they torture you? Did they hold you down? Did they give you a noogie and make you do it? What did this people do to you that you have brought so great of sin upon them? So Aaron said, do not let the anger of the Lord become hot. You know the people, that they are set on evil. For they said to me. Again, that's his response. I mean, much like Saul, he fesses up. It's like, okay, yeah, I mean, they said that I did it. I was a part of it. Yeah, that's what I did. Again, servant of God. Became the Aaronic priesthood. But he also acquiesced to the people. As I said, it's replete throughout the Bible. It's also replete throughout the New Testament. We won't go into all of these. Peter, as we know, again, for note takers, Galatians 2, verses 11 through 13. Peter withdrew himself from eating and socializing with the Gentiles when he knew that other Jews had come down from James. You know what the stated reason is? He feared those who were of the circumcision. He feared them. He feared his social group. He feared his peers. What's even interesting about this is because of Peter's action, the rest of the Jews that were with Peter also followed him and withdrew. That social group, they narrowed it down. The need to satisfy that group was more important than the need to satisfy what God had said. Because at this time, they knew Gentiles were part of the body of Christ. And they knew they should be socializing because they were. When a social group shows up, they withdrew. And of course, Paul stood against him. But again, this is an interesting example. You can have, there are tighter social impacts on you. And it changed their views. It changed their world. It changed their behavior. And it does with us. Paul, at the end of this, even almost in a sense of seemingly astonishment, he writes, even Barnabas was carried away with this. Presuming Paul was genuinely surprised Barnabas fell for this. But it, again, it illustrates the strength of those groups and that pull on us. And again, these all have this commonality of directly conflicting what God said. The need to belong. That innate desire within us. We also have the members of the Jewish nation that were up for the Feast of Tabernacles, and they were curious about Jesus, but they wouldn't speak openly of it. Why? They wouldn't talk about it in public. They just whisper in the corners for fear of the Jews. Same dynamic. Parents of the blind man, again, these stories for those note takers again, John 9:17-23. They said this: "We know that this is our son," when they were confronted. "We know that this is our son and that he was born blind. But by what means he now sees, we do not know. Or who opened his eyes, we do not know. He is of age, ask him. He will speak for himself." His parents said these things. Why? Same words. For fear of the Jews. For the Jews had agreed that if anyone confessed that he was the Christ, he would be put out of the synagogue. They were going to be kicked out of their social club. Not again, it's a religious thing, I get that. But they would be excommunicated if they acknowledged that Jesus is the one that just healed their son. And again, I'm putting this example up to illustrate the strength of that desire. The social group had such a strength, you wouldn't acknowledge the person that just healed your son. I think that is illustrative of how strong it can be for us. And again, the Pharisees, it's almost like shooting fish in a barrel, so I'm not going to read a lot of it. But they gave alms that they may have, what? Glory of men. That's why they did it. They prayed that they may be seen by men. They fasted that they may appear to men. All of this motivated and driven by the need to be accepted and to belong. All of it. There are many, many lessons I think we can draw from this. And again, it's just all I wanted today was to bring to an awareness, to refresh our minds of the need for this innate desire, but also its impact on our life. And that it can never, never, never supplant our deepest desire to serve our God. Our peers don't have that right. They don't have the authority to change who you are because they want you to become the way they are if it goes against God. Again, socializing, great. Don't hit people. Be nice to them. Talk, smile, do whatever is normal in a social environment. None of those are against God's laws. But as takeaways, it is important for us to remember the Christian walk. And again, when we bring this back into the realm of Christianity, the Christian walk is not a populist one. It's just not. Sometimes, perhaps most of the time, the godly view will emphatically not be popular. Right now, it's pretty good. We also know, we read a couple verses early on, that the time is coming when it will not be pretty good. The social pressure, if you will, and again, that's sort of modernizing the term, will be great. Our need for belonging, our need for acceptance, must first and foremost always be fulfilled in Christ. That has to be the center stem. That has to be the core. It has to be the vine that runs through the soul and being of your life and every other community, including family, including this church. Everything runs and stems off of that, and everything is connected to it. All social acceptance has to start with your desire to be socially acceptable with God, if you will, if I can use that as a phrase. Everything else is subordinate to that. You remove that vine, you pull that out, chaos ensues. Because you will be pulled in 400 different directions, and you will get pulled by varying groups. Now, hopefully you've developed groups that have similar behaviors and actions and patterns in your life. But you don't always get that luxury with things like work. And what will happen if that happens? The loudest group, the loudest social group will be change your behaviors, change your thoughts, and change your attitudes, and they will become your God because you will do what that group wants you to. Even people that are striving to follow God have done so. It's, again, we've read through several examples. If you're ever struggling, if you ever don't belong, feel like you belong, this is one of the best places to be, right here, or watching through that. Because, brethren, you've got the best belonging ever that can never be taken away unless you walk away from it. You belong to a long line, a unbroken line. Read Hebrews 11. You're part of that line. Not by name, but you are. That's your best social group. That's your peer group. That's who you should conform to, men and women of faith. Men and women that dedicated their life and said, I don't care what this world. They were sojourners. They were pilgrims. They didn't view this as their homeland. You're part of that. You've been gifted with that. You've been given that opportunity. Again, it may be lonely being a Christian, true follower of Christ, looking at the Bible and doing what it says. But you're not alone in reality, because that's an eternal community that you're a part of. And I guess the last lesson, or probably aren't lessons, more just things to contemplate, but it is only Christ and the gospel message that will ever set men free from the tyranny of social approval. And there is a tyranny to it. You're bound to it. But again, when you realize you're part of the community of God, if you will, the church today, and I should clarify, the only reason I say church before is because churches aren't always perfect. You always have to go to the Bible. Thankfully, we belong to a church that strives very, very hard and has a whole process put in place to make sure that we are as close to the biblical teaching as possible. It's a blessing, huge blessing. But it is only Christ that will ever separate us or give us that freedom to be okay with the fact that my coworkers think I'm a little weird. My boss doesn't understand why I don't work on Saturday or won't do other things. It's okay. And you can have an enormous amount of peace with that. I do want to kind of cycle back to the beginning. For the last verses we'll read. John 15. Again, similar type of thought from where we were before. These are verses we often read at the Passover, some of the last discourses Christ gave to his disciples. But again, it's interesting if you sort of enter a lot of Christ's teachings, especially some of the last ones, and especially some of those directly to his 12, his disciples, how much of them are about, not directly this concept, but the idea that you have a hard road to hoe and you have to stick with this, and you're going to have problems in this life. And again, I just pulled out a few verses. John 15, we'll start in verse 18. He says, if the world hates you, you know that it hated me before it hated you. If you were of the world would love its own. Yet because you are not of the world, but because I chose you out of the world, therefore the world hates you. Not a good social group. Remember the word that I said to you, a servant is not greater than his master. If they persecuted me, they will also persecute you. If they kept my word, they will keep yours also. But all these things they will do to you for my name's sake, because they do not know him who sent me. Drop down to chapter 16, verses 1 through 4. He says this, and again, this is very helpful because he just described a fairly bleak, you're going to have a hard road. And again, he was talking to 12. I understand that. But by extension, we will experience some of these things in part. He says, these things I have spoken to you that you should not be made to stumble. It's actually the same word for offense. You will not stumble. You will not fall away. That they will put you out of the synagogues. Yes, the time is coming that whoever kills you will think he offers God a service. Again, think about that, the examples we read. People that were willing to do things, but saying, but I'm serving God. They had directly disobeyed God, but I serve God. It's a similar thought here. They'll put you out of the synagogues, and time is coming. Whoever kills you will think he offers God a service. And these things they will do to you because they have not known the Father nor me. But these things I have told you, that when these things come, you will remember that I told you of them. And again, just the knowledge that they're coming allows us to prepare our minds. Brethren, so far, and again, the people he was talking to here, so far as we know, all the disciples died alone. They died alone with the whole world against them. Not a friend nearby. And since the time of Christ, saints and martyrs have stood alone, deserted by every earthly friend. Many of whom who died with the near universal displeasure of all mankind. We too must steel our resolve that if it comes to it, if it comes down to it, and we are required to stand alone for the name of Jesus Christ, no matter what, we will indeed stand alone.